This is Detention, a podcast dedicated to candid conversations about education. I'm your host, Dr. Nadia Lopez, a global leader, author, speaker, coach, consultant, and entrepreneur who opened a school to close a prison. Join me as I share my insights and bring fellow disruptors to serve time in conversation. Rebels, let's get into some good trouble. Welcome to a new episode of Detention. Today, I am sharing with you 7 pitfalls that teachers should avoid before the struggle becomes real in the classroom. Now, they are in no particular order, and they are based solely on my experience or situations I've witnessed firsthand. The first one is failing to build trust and establishing relationships from day one. Now, children are very intuitive. Even when they appear to be closed off, you have to take into consideration that many of them may be dealing with issues of trauma, low self-esteem, or just have a hard time warming up to people they just meet. You're new to them and they're new to you, so the process of getting to know each other is going to be very important. I know plenty of books and teacher preparation programs that advise teachers to be very serious, to remain firm, and enforce the rules from day one. And it's not a terrible idea, but I do get concerned when they are embedded with institutionalized beliefs and lack an explanation. It's more about do as I say, and there shouldn't be any problems, which can actually lead to a lot of rebellion and anarchy by a small group of students who can cause the most disruption. So what I suggest is that you approach them by engaging in a conversation and just starting out with who you are and what led you to teaching and what goals you have for them. I would tell my students that the reason I became a teacher was because I had some of the most incredible individuals who believed in me. They were my cheerleaders. But that I also had a particular teacher who didn't ask me if anything was wrong at a time that I was failing. I had been failing literally 3 classes, and this was in high school. I had gone from being a 90 student to probably an average of 59, right? Like, how does that happen and no one pay attention? Now, this teacher, rather than pull me aside, ask me if there was anything wrong, decided to embarrass me in the middle of the hallway and told me that because I didn't care about her class and I wasn't passing, that I would really never amount to anything. And then proceeded to call my mother and told her that she should never consider saving any more money for me to go to college because it was just a wasteless thought and nothing would ever come of it. You know, I thought it was the most disrespectful thing that the teacher could do, but I wasn't going to allow her to deter me from being college bound. Instead, I drew off of the teachers that I did have that always made me feel like there wasn't anything I couldn't do and continuously had instilled positive words of affirmation in my life. Needless to say, I did end up going to college. I went to summer school and I had to take the classes over, but it was a wake-up call. I ended up getting a degree in nursing, a master's in education, right? And then being conferred a doctorate. But at the end of the day, what I decided that I would want to become is a great teacher, more than she had done for me. And so what I would like to point out is that you have the influence over children when you're a teacher through your words and your actions. And when you show them who you are, then you can talk about why the rules have been established and how this is to help them create a safe environment where there's respect, high expectations, and the results will be positive outcomes for them. So number 2, the second pitfall is not willing to be open to feedback. This is something that, oh my God, I saw time and time again, but it became worse when I was a principal. And it's because there's so many teachers who find it hard for someone to tell them how to improve their pedagogy. And I guess it's because the way society sets teachers up, when we think about education, the individual who's imparting information is supposed to be all knowledgeable. But the best teachers are also the best learners, right? And in order to improve your practices, you have to be willing to hear the feedback. Now, some of you may be asking, but what happens if the feedback is coming from someone who doesn't know how to teach or lacks competence? Which I've seen that too. Then this is where number three is going to come from. But before we get to that, what I want to say is that being open to feedback is hearing what the person is saying and being reflective on your practices as a teacher. So if they're saying to you, you need to develop methods of checking for understanding, by looking at your lesson plan, there are no questions that helps you to anticipate what you should ask in order to determine if a child understands the work. So the recommendation would be for you to write out your questions. There are a lot of teachers who feel like, well, why do I have to do that? Because when you're in the moment of teaching, you will forget. And at least if you have it on your lesson plan and you've written it out, it just becomes part of your delivery of instruction or something that you can refer to jog your memory. But that's just a small idea that I'm presenting. There are so many more. What I'm saying ultimately is be open to the feedback. Take a minute to self-reflect. And hopefully the person who's giving you the information is someone who is of competence. But if they're not, then what I would suggest is that you go and seek support, which is what brings us to number three. There are so many teachers in classrooms who do not seek support. And sometimes it comes from lacking humility, and other times it's kind of feeling like embarrassed or ashamed to ask someone for help. Either way, the goal is to make sure that kids are learning and to make sure that you have the skills in order to do the best job as a teacher. So you should seek help from veterans, those teachers who have the experience and the ones who love helping other teachers become really, really good by sharing their, you know, strategies and tricks that they use in their classrooms, and will take you under their wing. So whether you go into their classroom to observe their teaching practices or you have them observe your class, allows for a conversation in which they can give you really great feedback in real time. And if for any reason your schedules don't allow for you to actually engage in the visiting of classrooms, ask them if they could tape their class for you to observe it, or you can tape your class so that they can look at it and give you the feedback that you need. Now, you think about your lessons, that's also a point of support, you know, in identifying the gaps that may occur during your instructional practices. Being able to see how you're planning things from beginning to end and whether or not you're missing some pieces during your direct instruction or the parts in which the students are supposed to be engaging in the practice and application of what they were to learn will help you to start anticipating the needs of your students, ensuring that everyone is being included, and then you be able to modify wherever necessary. Now, when I started teaching, let me tell you, I was a special education teacher in a collaborative team teaching class. And so I was given a textbook, the teacher's edition for a social studies course. And my co-teacher was teaching English. And I want to tell you that I was not prepared. I had no idea what I was doing. I thought that by writing this lesson plan, which was basic, was going to make me the best teacher. I promise you, 45 minutes felt like an hour. I wasn't thinking about how my objective actually was connected to the outcome. I wasn't thinking about the activities that would allow the students to actually engage in their own learning. It was so teacher-centered. It was me focused on definitions. It was me talking them through every part of the learning, but it wasn't them actually doing anything. I was terrible. And the kids were bored to tears, and I was frustrated, and I was blaming them, when in actuality, what they were telling me is, you got to do better. I had to humble myself. And as a result, what I started to do was observe my co-teacher. I observed how she took time to really think about every student in the classroom and included them in the learning. I observed how she didn't just stick to the book that they were reading, but also brought in extended learning, which meant that she connected them to watching a TED Talk, or she had them listen to music that would be associated with the type of cultural experience that they were describing in the book. She made the classroom come alive. She gave each of them an opportunity to have voice. She knew her content, and she understood the art of teaching. And then I thought she was just too magical, so I went into other teachers' classrooms, and those veterans that I saw were just as exciting and insightful, and I realized I needed help. And so I started to observe what they did and started to ask them for their feedback and started to improve my own pedagogy. Because at the end of the day, it wasn't about me. It was really about making sure that these young people got the information and that they were going to be successful so that they were prepared for the next grade. And just, you know, life in general. So now, on to the fourth pitfall. This is the part where we hate to hear it, but it's all about not knowing the data. You know, tests are not the end all be all prior to contrary thoughts. Okay. If you wait for the test to give you what the outcomes will be for your students, is way too late. The reality is that throughout your instruction, from the time you start the day with young people, you're getting data. It starts with greeting them. Good morning, good afternoon, how you doing? You learn a lot about a child through their demeanor and how they respond, because children can't learn when they're not focused and when they don't feel safe, when they are hungry, when they didn't have a good night's rest. So it may be that they are going to have a bad day in class if you don't address these issues, that they're going to be disconnected. Right. So just simply starting the day off with good morning, good afternoon, and checking in provides you with data. The second thing is you have to be willing to check for understanding throughout your instruction by giving opportunities for questioning, right? Asking those good questions, giving children time to turn and talk, listening and walking around while you circulate and hearing the conversations that are being had and whether they're on task and on target. And if it's not, recognizing where you have to circle back, reteach, or ask them where they need clarification. Being able to integrate software is another great way of checking for children's understanding and getting immediate data real time. Now, I did a poll of various teachers that I am still connected to, those who worked for me and those who are friends, and many of them have named a couple, and these are not by any means sponsored, but something just of a suggestion. So there's Pear Deck, Nearpod, Google Forms, Kahoot, Quizzes, Jamboard, Edpuzzles, Plickers, and Padlet. They all utilize these in order to get real-time responses to see how many of the students in their classrooms actually understood a concept that they taught, and they found it was a fun and engaging way because it wasn't just about the teacher doing all of the talking, but the kids actually engaging. Okay? And then we have the traditional exit tickets. You know, answer this question before you leave class. These slips are collected, and then the teacher is able to see whether or not the children mastered whatever the information they were being taught for that day. There's also share outs that you should be doing at the end of class to make sure that there's a summarization, but you don't get to hear everybody summarize it. So you look at those exit tickets, or you may look at the homework, and the homework can tell you whether or not they understood the work, whether there was someone at home that could support them with the work, or if they lacked the completion of the work because maybe something else is going on. At the end of the day, all of this can happen on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to you waiting for the test or end of unit assignment. That's way, way, way too late. You can literally create interventions. You can literally target the student's needs by doing these checks throughout your instructional practice on a day-to-day basis. Number five is really a big one. And you may say to yourself, no, she didn't go there, but I am. It is the pitfall of joining the peanut gallery. And when I say that, this isn't a good thing. These are when colleagues engage in gossip, complain, and are so ineffective in their practices that they love to focus on everything negative rather than having discussions about how to improve, or better yet, seek employment somewhere else. Right? They say misery loves company, and that is a fact. When I was a teacher, I would hear my colleagues all the time complain so badly about administration. Day after day, they would go to lunch with each other to talk about the administration and about the kids. They would go to happy hour and talk about all the drama at work. And there are a lot of people who get sucked into this behavior, but this is so unproductive and very toxic. And the reality is that your job is not for you to entertain negativity, but to focus on the children in your classroom. And if you become unhappy with your working conditions and you have expressed it to the administration and there is no resolve, after sharing those concerns, you need to make an executive decision about whether or not you will stay or you're going to leave. That's right. Apply for another school and stop wasting your time or breath on the things that you can't control. This happened at the first school that I worked at. I would literally hear my colleagues outside of my door talking about everything that was negative. And I spent my time during lunch tweaking my resume. When I went home, I was going on interviews, phone interviews, or going to schools and doing interviews. I wasn't going to stay there. I wasn't going to allow myself to be sucked into all of this negativity, right? When I finally left the school, after that, it was a couple of years in, and we had a New York City open market, and I was able to leave. I remember a couple of them calling me, like, what happened? Where are you? And I said to them, oh, I applied to another job, and I got it. And so, yeah, I'm working at a new school. They were so surprised. And I said to them, you know, all that time y'all were wasting, you didn't take time to actually start focusing on yourselves. Now, I went from becoming a founding teacher of a new school, going into a leadership program, becoming an assistant principal, and then opening up my own school. And guess what? Many of those same teachers who were my colleagues remained at the same school, still complaining about the same things. And when I opened my school, they said to me, you think maybe I could work for you? And I'm gonna tell you what the answer was. No. Because what I didn't want was for them to bring that energy. And the reality is that they had years and years and years to make an executive decision. And we all know what people do in one place, they'll continue to do in another place. So I didn't need to bring that into my school's ecosystem. And so I say to you this, do not join the peanut gallery. The sixth pitfall is allowing your biases and unfamiliarity with the community, its culture, or the family dynamics to make up assumptions based on stereotypes. So when I worked in communities that were underprivileged, there were teachers who just assumed that every child was poor and that parents didn't care or weren't nearly as intelligent as them. They never understood the complexities of the community. So to them, the kids were just apathetic or too aggressive. Without understanding, they were demonstrating coping mechanisms of survival, right? They were just trying to get to school safe and get back home safe. And this was the reason why when I became a principal, it was very important for me to have my staff actually walk around in the community. I wanted them to recognize what it was like to live in these type of communities and what the children endured. And the reason why is because I, no matter where I worked, would always take time to go through the neighborhood, like literally park my car, walk around, frequent the spots that the kids went to the stores that they purchased items from, ate at the local eateries, even if it was like quick meals, right? Because they didn't have restaurants in the neighborhoods, but they did have places where they would frequent. And so I started to become invested in where they lived, and they recognized that. I would reach out to parents, not just because their child had done something wrong, but to just say hello, to check in, and also to give praise when needed. And whenever I had to, I would do a drive-by. That's right. I would go to children's houses, because if you wasted my time during class, I had time to waste yours and your parents while you were at home, so that we could be all on the same accord. I'm here to teach, and I'm here to be respected. And your house is my house. My class is your class. And I got a lot of love and praise from that, because at the end of the day, they saw that I was willing to go above and beyond. But I'm going to say this, know your community, right? And do it out of love, not out of power and trying to check people. Now, that was in the underprivileged communities, but let me explain to you, the same thing happened when I was working in the suburbs of Cobb County in Georgia. Oh, it opened my eyes, because, you know, you think children are living in houses and, you know, they have it better off. But that's also an assumption, because there were children who were dealing with a lot of personal issues. There was a student who teachers would often describe as that kid who would go postal. And I felt uncomfortable when they said that, because you don't describe that about a kid. And they were like, you know, he's the type of child that, you know, if a gun is going to be involved, it may be him. And guess what? This young man had a manifesto in class, and he described how he was going to terminate many of his peers. Out of concern, of course, it was reported to the principal, and the sheriff's office came to the building, the police, special agents, and they went to his home. And guess what they found? Lots of ammunition, a number of guns. And he literally had a shooting range in his backyard. And his parents thought that this was normal because, hey, we live in Georgia and kids grow up with guns and that's what they do. Not in Brooklyn, not where I'm from. I was like, that's not what happens. But this could have been a bigger issue, right? And then there was also one of my students who, he and I used to talk all the time about his lateness. And I told him he couldn't come to class late because it was concerning to me that he wasn't getting what he needed the first 15 minutes of class. And he said, Miss Lopez, I promise you I won't be late anymore. And he wasn't. But guess what? The assistant principal called me and asked me to escort this young person to the office. And I saw officers in the main office, only to find out that this young person had been engaging in home invasions with a group of other young men. And they were putting all of the things in their lockers, right? And not to mention the kids who were living in a two-family home where the parents weren't necessarily concerned about the child. They were so focused on their work, or they were focused on their social lives, that they didn't even pay attention that this child was taking opioids and getting high. I share this to say that it doesn't matter where kids live, and we make these assumptions that one zip code is better than the other. the things that I saw happening in Cobb County, I didn't experience when I was working in Brooklyn, right? I didn't see that. But people would say, oh, to live in the suburbs is better. At the end of the day, we need to understand children and make sure that we are in constant communication with them. So check your biases at the door. Don't make assumptions and get to know the community. Now, last but not least, what I want to tell every teacher is that you must put things in writing. It is very important that you maintain proof of communication. So whether that is a request that you make to an administrator, if it's a follow-up conversation to that you've had with a parent, or a concern that you have about one of your students that you need to make everybody else aware so that no one says, well, why didn't you report it or why didn't you say something? Put it in writing, because you need to learn how to protect yourself and to keep proof if you're ever called into question. Because I'm going to tell you this, if it's not on paper, it does not exist. And the best practice is to always remember, your job is always on the line. If for any reason you failed to do what you needed to, they would write you up. That's called a paper trail. Whatever you need in terms of making sure that there is a protection, put it in writing. Always ever on the side of caution. Now, I hope by serving detention with me today and learning about these seven pitfalls that teachers, or those that you know that are teaching, will avoid the very pitfalls that so many have succumbed to and often feel like they're not good enough for this profession, or have had the worst of the worst happen, like the license be revoked. I want to avoid that. I want folks to love what they do, but know that these are part of the processes that you have to learn by hook or crook in order to be as effective as possible. So until next time. Thank you for serving time with me here in detention. Don't forget to subscribe and to tell a friend so that this way you're up to date on new episodes that will drop every week. You can also follow us on Instagram at Detention Podcast. If you want to learn more about my services as a coach, consultant, and keynote speaker, go to www.thelopezeffect.com. And let's stay connected on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by following me on my handle, The Lopez Effect. Lastly, if you have any topic ideas, questions or comments, or want to sponsor future episodes, please send me an email at detentionwithdrnadialopez@gmail.com. All of this information will be in the show notes, so don't worry if you didn't get it down. I also want to send a gentle reminder to my disruptors and rebels. It's okay for us to get into a little bit of good trouble, but please take gentle care of yourself, be well, and never forget to choose you.